the station of the nations, AM 1270, WHLD, Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York, a Citadel Broadcasting Communications Station.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greeting, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
It's Monday, October 11th, and welcome to today's show. This is Dr. Rob Stahl with What Should You Expect at Your Age? What should you expect at your age is a lot. And my listeners, especially the older adults and caregivers out there, shouldn't settle for less. We're going to start today's show with our station engineer, Mr. Jimmy Smith, reading Expectations for Older Adults.
By Dr. Robert S. Stahl, M.D. You should expect to be listened to, valued and respected. You should expect knowledgeable and compassionate health care. You should expect to be given medications that will only make you feel better, not worse. You should expect never to be abandoned or forgotten. You should expect not to live a life of loneliness or depression. You should expect to live life as pain-free as possible. You should expect never to be the object of prejudice or abuse. You should expect to get the help you need to live life to the fullest. You should expect to live up to your potential and have hope for the future. And lastly, you should expect never to be taken advantage of. Repeat, never to be taken advantage of, except for your talents, knowledge, and wisdom. Great words, Dr. Stahl.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. Last week we talked about hearing problems with several wonderful guests. We covered a lot of very good information. Today's show is about infections in older adults. We'll talk about how older people can react differently and often more seriously to infectious diseases, other things that predispose you to infection, which are the most common bugs out there looking to make you sick, how to minimize your chances of catching them, and what to do if you do get an infection. I have in the studio today Dr. Joseph Mylott, Chief of Infectious Disease at the Erie County Medical Center. The phone number for your calls is 855-6848, and we're all here, Dr. Mylott, myself, and even Jimmy, to answer your questions. Welcome, Dr. Mylott.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to specialize in combating infection?
Well, I was trained initially in internal medicine. During that time of training in internal medicine, I developed an interest in infectious diseases and decided to specialize in that area in the late 1970s. I was influenced a lot by several of the faculty that I was mentored by who were excellent infectious disease specialists at that time. This is the mid-70s now. And because of that exposure to them, I developed an interest in infectious diseases.
Why don't you mention a few of the people that you encountered during your training?
Dr. James Allen, who was the chief of infectious disease for the university in the 1970s, was my major mentor, along with Dr. Mike Apicella, who subsequently took over as chief in the 1980s through the early 1990s, and Dr. Martin Plaut, who I got to know very well, especially early in my career as an intern and resident, and then subsequently as a faculty member at the School of Medicine.
Let's start off with an interview I did this past Friday with one of my patients. You'll hear several throughout today's show, and we'll start with this one.
Is arthritis considered an infection?
No. No, something that made you sick, that gave you a fever, that might have been oozing pus, something like that.
I've had nothing like that.
No bad cold or the flu or a urine infection or eye infection or an infected tooth or jaw or abscess, nothing.
No, no.
And how old are you?
I'll be 87 next week.
87. So your immune system must be pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we heard from one of my patients that has been lucky to avoid infections. But we discussed a little bit about the definition of infection, and it's not arthritis. What can you tell us about how we can define an infection?
Well, an infection, in the most basic terms, means that you acquire an organism that you are not immune to, and the organism multiplies in your body, and you have a bodily response to that, usually inflammation, but it doesn't necessarily have to be true inflammation. So most people have had experiences, for instance, with the common cold and other minor infections like that. Now, some infections, some organisms may infect the body but never cause any symptoms. And that's actually fairly common. So someone may say, gee, I never had chicken pox, but when we check for immunity, they obviously have been infected, but they were asymptomatic or never had any symptoms. So that actually occurs quite commonly. So someone who says they've never had infection that they can recall probably have had a lot of minor infections with very little symptoms or no symptoms at all. For instance, someone that age clearly has had to have had measles, chicken pox, mumps, and so forth, because they grew up at a time when we did not have vaccines for those particular viral infections. So they had infections, but they were minor to that individual and didn't cause any problem.
So there are infections that you might not even realize that you had.
Exactly.
I think tuberculosis is another one that people have been what's called exposed to it. And whether you call it exposure or a low-grade infection that doesn't produce the symptoms that we typically associate with infection, but people, when tested for tuberculosis with a skin test generally, often are positive without any knowledge of having had the tuberculosis.
That's correct. It's called latent infection, and actually most people who that's the largest group of people who have had tuberculosis are those who are infected but are in a latent stage and actually never get any signs or symptoms of tuberculosis.
So the immune system serves to take care of these low-grade infections that we might not even know that we have, and also serves to prevent infection from bugs that are in the environment. And the world is loaded with these little bugs. They're on your skin, they're on tabletops, they're on every surface. And so what are typical symptoms of infection? We know fever is often associated with infection. In older people, though, fever of 104 might not be that common, but a low-grade fever might be.
Well, this is the party line, as it were, in infectious disease, that older individuals don't typically mount a fever many times. And I would strongly disagree with that statement. I take care of people who are elderly pretty much on a daily basis. And many of them mount significant fever responses, 102, 103, 104. The issue is we have a lot of people who don't have a fever, but maybe they don't feel as good, they don't eat, they're not eating as well, they have trouble with their usual daily activities. And the question is that non-specific response a manifestation or a sign of infection? And many people teach that that's the case, and especially in older individuals. And it can be that these non-specific kinds of symptoms that have nothing to do with a definite infection could be a sign of infection. The problem is the infection can be in any part of the body. So a urinary tract infection may just not make you feel good, but you can't really pin it down exactly what the source of infection is. Someone with pneumonia may just be lethargic, sleepy, without any cough, without any fever initially. But eventually, that will occur over time as the pneumonia progresses untreated. So initially, the symptoms of infection, whether it's virus, bacterial, or what, or whatever, but primarily those two types of organisms, they may be nonspecific in their in the symptoms that they that people have, but eventually the symptoms and signs will focus down on the area of the body that's problematic. The question is trying to, or the issue is trying to identify these sites of infections earlier on before there are significant signs and symptoms.
Does that mean that that the disease has progressed, that there's more right. bugs that right. are in the body, and it's harder for you to combat them right. at that point?
Right. So at a certain point in time, the organism defeats the host or the ability to respond, and that's when the signs and symptoms progress.
Now, we're going to talk about symptoms of specific diseases as we go along. I think that's the best way to organize this next hour. Let's just go back to the whole issue of fever again. And is 98.6 the normal temperature that we should be looking at to measure a fever?
Well, again, there's a lot of debate about this issue, especially in the elderly, because of this situation where people feel that the elderly don't mount as much of a fever response to infection as, say, someone who's a lot younger. So some people have advocated reducing the so-called normal range of temperature in the elderly downward, say 97, for instance, instead of 98.6. So a temperature of 99 would be then a 2-degree increase, and that would be, if you added 2 degrees to 98.6, should be 100.6, and that we would call that fever in most individuals. If you reduce the cutoff for a normal range, for instance, to 97, then 99 becomes a fever in an elderly person. I think it's a very arbitrary situation, and I've tried to avoid this discussion because no one really knows the answer.
Well, would it help if people, when they feel good, take their temperature and tell me if this happens or doesn't happen, if it's of any use to people? Let's say they're normal when they feel well, their temperature actually is 97.6 as opposed mm-hmm. to 98.6. Can that be taken as that person's normal well temperature and then use that 2-degree difference from that 97.6 to help measure whether they truly have a fever or not?
Sure. the problem is...
I know you don't like getting into this discussion.
The problem is no one knows what their normal range is because we don't go around taking our temperature when we feel okay. So you'd have to say, all right, to everybody, well, for a few days, just measure your temperature 2 or 3 times a day. And, of course, the temperature fluctuates, as you know, depending on the time of the day and so on and so forth. So this is why I dislike this discussion of you know, the fever response, because no one really knows what the normal is for any individual. When we say 98.6, the range is quite wide around that, which is normal, if you will. But 98.6 is the average norm, you know, it's the bell-shaped curve phenomenon. So, as you know, better than me. Everything is relative. So I think when people are ill and you think they have infection, yes, they should take their temperature, and that will give you some relative assessment of the fever response in that individual. And I would leave it at that, to be perfectly
okay.
honest with you.
Now, just one last question on temperature, and then we'll go on to other things. Oral temperature versus other types of temperature. There are devices that can measure temperature in the ear. There's the old standby rectal temperature, which I think gets more difficult to use as you get older. It's easier when you're a kid and you have a mom, or usually a mom who's happy to do that for you. What advice can you say about that?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I think most of the time, you'll see now in the hospital setting and in many other settings using oral temps. You know, they have the automated machines now and so forth. The rectal temperature is probably more accurate in terms of measuring the core temperature, for sure, but it's a lot easier to get an oral temperature on most people as nursing staff are going around making their rounds. The tympanic,
that's the ear.
The ear, the measurement of temperature via the ear is also a nice quick way to do it. There's been some argument about the accuracy of it at times. And so you don't see that used as much anymore. Probably in children more commonly than adults. So I think adults are getting oral temperatures most of the time in most settings, with the rectal temperature being done if you're in an intensive care setting, for instance, where they can monitor it almost continuously. So I think most of the time oral temperatures are being used, and I think that's satisfactory.
Okay, let's go on to things that predispose people to infection, people that might be at high risk for getting infection. And I want to play the next clip from my patients.
The bronchitis bothered me. It scared me because I'm trying to treat myself, and I couldn't. And I finally had to have antibiotics and whatever. And I don't want to go through that again.
Why did it scare you?
Because I couldn't get my breath. And I just felt like I was on the way out.
Now, this patient has chronic lung disease from smoking for many years. And certainly that's one of the risk factors for infection, is having chronic disease of certain organs. Certainly the lungs is one. What can you tell us about the different risk factors that predispose people to getting infections?
Well, the example here that the person you just mentioned has chronic lung disease, and certainly a respiratory infection, primarily viral, but also bacterial, is a substantial problem in these individuals. And they always are sicker than other people without lung disease because they already have significant damage to their respiratory tract due to the smoking and so forth. So when they get infection of the respiratory tract, they always get short of breath and so forth. And as described by this individual, that she was quite ill, short of breath, it was very annoying and difficult for her. So lung disease obviously is a major predisposing factor to lung infection or lower respiratory infection like bronchitis, which is 95% viral.
What is it about the lung? What's each organ? Many organs have their own protective mechanisms against disease, and so give an example of the lung in particular. What in the lung helps to prevent against disease?
There's two major defense mechanisms against infection in terms of the respiratory tract, and that is the cells lining the respiratory tract have these hair-like structures that are coated with this mucus, and the mucus flow is from in upwards out. And so when you cough, you're coughing up particles that are trapped, if you will, on these hair-like structures and mucus. So that's a major host defense mechanism against aspirating bacteria or viruses into the lung. There's also white blood cells that are very specific for the respiratory tract, which are there immediately to fight off infection when you inhale a virus or bacteria. Those are the cough reflex are the main defense mechanisms. And if you think about it, we're constantly bombarding the lung with foreign particles, whether they're infectious or not, so that these defense mechanisms work very well. People with chronic lung disease, those defense mechanisms are not functional, or they're functioning less, so their risks are much higher.
Now, what about other predisposing factors?
Well, there are many. For instance, diabetics seem to have an increased risk of infection, skin infections and urinary tract infections. People with chronic heart disease, kidney disease, are also at risk. For instance, this is one of the reasons why we vaccinate those people with influenza vaccine, because of their increased risk of this type of infection and the complications of the infection. People with liver disease, any chronic disease that afflicts a specific organ always predisposes or increases the risk of infection and the complications of infection. So, and the other issue nowadays is the many medications that we use to treat some of these diseases. For instance, if you have chronic lung disease, some people are on steroids, which help the lung disease, but also decrease the body's immune capabilities, and so increase the risk of certain types of infection. And there's all sorts of new treatments that are out there now for certain diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and diseases like that that also increase substantially the risk of infection. So,
because that also suppresses the right. immune system,
exactly.
the immune system being that system in the body that's there to fight disease.
And I'm not trying to dissuade people from taking these medications because they're important for the treatment of the problem. But there is a downside to it, and physicians using these medications, of course, educate their patients about the limitations.
Well, certainly people should be aware that the medications can make them more susceptible to infection and take proper precautions, which we'll get into, what types of preventive approaches we could take. Are there any other predisposing factors? I know people with stroke, I see this a lot in the nursing home setting, because they can't swallow properly. People with Parkinson's disease, likewise, in advanced stages, also have trouble swallowing properly.
Yeah, this is a major predisposing factor, the swallowing problems, with, as you say, with stroke, dementia, Parkinson's, all have this problem of swallowing difficulties, which increase the risk of pneumonia. For sure, for certain.
And reflux disease, what can you say about that? Is that also something that predisposes to
this? I think it's certainly on the list of predisposing factors. It's hard to separate that out from the swallowing problems many times because these are two common problems. So I think people have looked at treating people with frequent episodes of pneumonia with anti-reflux agents, but there are no studies to support that at the present time.
Now, earlier we were talking, preparing for the show, and you mentioned some new ways to prevent lung infections, in particular using ACE inhibitors.
Right now, ACE inhibitors are used for the treatment of hypertension very frequently, the Japanese have made some interesting observations about the following. If you have a group with stroke who are being treated for hypertension with an ACE inhibitor, and then you have another group with stroke who are not on an ACE inhibitor, the ones who are on an ACE inhibitor have a markedly decreased risk of pneumonia. And one of the side effects of the ACE inhibitor is an increased coughing.
And often it's an annoying, nagging cough that is hard to pin down until you realize someone's on an ACE inhibitor. And ACE inhibitors are drugs like Zestril as a brand name, Acupril.
There's a variety of them, and very often the cough becomes so annoying that the drug is stopped. But on the other hand, it stimulates the cough reflex and may be in the future used to prevent infection in these individuals. So they're a very interesting phenomenon.
And certainly older age itself, because of the waning of the immune response as one gets older, older age itself predisposes to infection. Let's listen to the next clip from my patients.
Tell me about the worst infection you've had as an older adult.
I have had none.
No infections.
Have I had any infections? No. Not for the last 20 years. I broke a leg once, I think, but that wasn't an infection.
Okay, that was a 92-year-old patient of mine who really hasn't had an infection. And I think his genetic makeup may have had something to do with that, and the fact that he's living to be 92, into his 90s. What are ways to prevent infections?
Well, there's, you know, the individual you had on the clip, it's interesting because you run into people like that periodically, and I think it's a function of there is a genetic, you know, background that may decrease the risk of infection, and certainly no one really can explain that from a scientific point of view. I think there's also good luck involved, but one of the ways to prevent infection is to just live the life of a hermit, essentially, because most of the infections that we acquire, if you will, come from exposure to other individuals who are sick, at least when we live out in the community setting. And most of these are viral infections, and some are bacterial, but most are viral. And of course, we, in the hospital setting, we're very concerned about spread of bacteria, resistant bacteria, from person to person. But you know, vaccination is important in the prevention of infection in all age groups. Nutrition, good nutrition, is also a factor. I think, and like I said, the genetic background of the individual is also a factor to some degree.
And good hand washing. Hand washing, avoiding sneezing directly at someone.
Hygiene. Good hygiene, obviously, is hand washing is actually probably the most important issue in terms of that, because it's on our hands that we pick up a lot of these organisms that are spread to us. Although, again, close contact with people with viral infection is, regardless of whether you're washing your hands or not, it will be spread to you, because it doesn't require hand contact. It's airborne, something we haven't really talked about. But airborne spread of infection is probably one of the most common ways that viruses are spread from person to person.
Now, what could be done about that, the airborne spread?
Well, not much. Let me give you an example.
Does Lysol spray do anything?
let me give you an example. With influenza, or flu, if you will, is spread by large droplets that get into the air over short distances. And people can be excreting or putting out these flu particles at least 24 hours before they have any symptoms. So they don't even know they have it. So once you develop symptoms, it's a different story. People tend to stay away from you because you're so sick. But that therein lies the problem. You can be releasing these infectious particles into the air, and you feel fine.
So anyone you've been around the 24 hours before you get sick also can get sick themselves.
Exactly. So this is you know, a problem in terms of trying to avoid anybody who's ill.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back talking a little more about the flu vaccine. We're in a shortage position right now in the United States, unfortunately, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Go into some other infections and how to treat them, and we'll be taking your calls again, 855-6848. So we'll take a short break now, and we'll be right back. I wanna jump, but I'm afraid I'll fall.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back now and with today's show entitled Infections in Older Adults. And if you'd like to call and ask me or Dr. Milana a question, the phone number again is 855-6848. Now, Jimmy, you had a question about hand washing liquids and things.
That's right. I've got some in the car I use for washing my hands when I don't have access to water. Are they good at the antibacterial type of liquid type of are they good?
Well, sure. We use them all the time in the hospital setting.
And nursing home setting and in my private practice.
Yeah. So the hand washing comes down to the mechanical aspect of washing one's hands using soap and water. That's really the optimum, the best way to do it. But very often you don't have access to a sink and water and so forth. So these products are very useful because they will they have an antibacterial effect, and they will definitely reduce the bacterial level on your hands over the short terms. And so, as I said, we use them extensively in institutional settings, hospitals, and so forth. So they are useful, but they're not as good as the mechanical washing of the hands with soap and water, but they'll do in the short term.
Okay. Now, one thing I did want to touch on was another factor that's not that obvious, and that's the role of dental hygiene and infection. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is a fascinating area, and it's one that some colleagues of mine in the dental school, Dr. Frank Scannapeco, and I have been working on for some time. One of our hypotheses, if you will, from a scientific point of view, was that poor oral hygiene in the elderly, in the nursing home setting and so forth, is a predisposing factor for the development of pneumonia.
Now, is this only in the nursing home or also in the community?
Well, there certainly is some evidence that that's the case in community-dwelling elderly people as well. Poor oral hygiene predisposing to pneumonia.
Does this include hygiene of dentures? Let's just get that clear also.
The studies have all been done with one's own teeth and looking at plaque and oral hygiene, not with dentures per se. So I don't have any comments about that, because I really don't know of any studies that looked at people just with the dentures, to be perfectly honest with you. But right now we are now doing, or just starting, Dr. Scannapeco and I'm participating in a NIH-sponsored study in the trauma unit at Erie County Medical Center, looking at oral hygiene and the development of pneumonia in people on mechanical ventilation, respirators, which is a very serious infection. The goal is to prevent these infections by improving oral hygiene. So there's been an increased interest in this area. There's also the correlation between chronic periodontal infection or periodontitis and heart disease and other cardiovascular illnesses. So that, again, people at the School of Dentistry have been looking into for several years. And again, improving oral hygiene, reducing cardiovascular risk, stroke, and so forth. Whether that's going to play out and actually be true is not clear at this point in time.
While we're on the topic of oral hygiene, some people, when they go to the dentist, are recommended to get antibiotics before they go. What can you tell us about that? Does it really prevent complications, or does giving the antibiotics predispose perhaps to resistant organisms because you're taking extra antibiotics? What's the latest on that?
I believe you're referring to using antibiotics prophylactically if they have, say, underlying heart valve problems, something
right.
like this. Yeah, that kind of therapy is very short term, so they may take just one dose of an antibiotic before the procedure, and that usually is it. That's usually the recommendation anyway. That probably doesn't predispose to any resistance developing. Does it prevent, the idea is to prevent, when you have a dental procedure, because of the types of things that are done, bacteria always get into the bloodstream in normal people during the dental procedure. They don't last very long, maybe 15 minutes at most, once the procedure has ended. The idea is that if bacteria get into the bloodstream and you have an abnormal heart valve or a valve replacement or something like that, the bacteria can then adhere or stick onto the damaged valve or prosthetic valve and then cause an infection of that tissue. The idea with the antibiotics is to have the antibiotic present to reduce the number of bacteria in the blood to reduce the risk or minimize the risk of infection. So that sounds good, but there's absolutely no evidence in the medical literature that that works in humans. There's a plenty of experimental data, but actually none in humans that it works. But those types of infections are so significant and so severe.
Very severe and can be life-threatening.
So the approach has been, we're going to do this.
Let's do it, and there's no real harm,
right.
Unless you have an allergy to the antibiotic.
Right, and of course, and you know, that is a small issue, but usually, you know, you've taken it before, and so you've got a good sense of what the risk is. So there isn't any proof, but the infection is so bad that you try to minimize the risk as much as possible.
Let's get into immunizations, and let's start with flu.
Well, everybody knows of the problem we're having this year with the influenza vaccine shortage. It's very important, though. Influenza vaccine is to focus on the importance of it in prevention of influenza. It's critical in certain groups of people, people with chronic diseases of the heart, lung, kidneys, diabetics, and so forth. The vaccine is very effective, usually, in preventing influenza. Why do we want to prevent influenza? Because of the complications that occur in these age groups, in the elderly and so forth, complications being the development of secondary pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia, or viral pneumonia, being the most significant complication, cardiovascular complications as a result of the infection, especially in elderly people, and, of course, death. There are, I think, the estimates that we read in the paper and are published, 35,000 people die each year related to influenza, most of whom are in the elderly.
And are those all people that have gotten the shot, or are those people who haven't gotten the shot?
Most of them have not been vaccinated. What's interesting about the vaccine, which you have to keep in mind, is that the vaccine effectiveness in preventing influenza actually decreases with age, because the immune response, as we've mentioned, decreases usually with age, and people do not respond as well in the older age groups. So this is why, and some of the people out there listening to this will relate to this, they've had a mother or a father, aunt or uncle or a friend who's in a nursing home who's been vaccinated, because, as you know, most nursing home residents are now vaccinated routinely against influenza, and there are still outbreaks of influenza occurring in nursing homes. Why is that? It's because the vaccine effectiveness is not that good in the elderly. However, we continue to use it because, although it doesn't prevent influenza, it is very effective in preventing complications. There's pretty good evidence for that, very good evidence. That pneumonia rates are less among those who are vaccinated versus those who are not. Death is significantly reduced, and so forth. So the driving force for influenza vaccine in the elderly is not necessarily to prevent influenza, which it will do to some extent, but to prevent the complications.
So it basically protects against a more severe influenza.
Right.
And when you get the severe influenza, that allows other bugs to take hold, and that's those other infections that can kill you.
Right. Correct.
Now, what about if someone can't get, let's say two scenarios. One, if someone isn't able to get the vaccine, and two, if someone does get the vaccine and they do get the flu, what can be done?
Well, the problem we're facing now is there's going to be a lot of people who are don't have access to the vaccine. So the goal should be to utilize the vaccine that's available for those at risk, the greatest risk of complications. And those have been spelled out pretty carefully in the newspaper and so forth.
These are people over 65.
Right. People who are younger than 65 with significant heart, lung, kidney disease, diabetes, people who are on drugs that suppress the immune system, transplants.
Steroids,
right. For instance, would be a major group.
And especially people over 65 that also have the chronic diseases. Yeah, they would be at very high risk.
Right, exactly. Nursing home populations, of course.
Anyone living in a group living center, like adult homes, senior apartment buildings?
Yes, almost all of those people. What we have to do is channel our resources into that group. Now, interestingly, if you look at what happens each year with influenza, children are the ones that are affected initially, primarily. And then it spreads to adults, and then finally gets into the older adults as the winter season moves on. So you'll see one of the recommendations is vaccinating very young children in that 6 month to 23 month age range, which is kind of interesting because that's a group that if you can vaccinate them and if the vaccine is effective, which it is, you may prevent spread to other individuals. And actually there have been studies sponsored by the NIH where they've gone to very small communities in the United States and just vaccinated only the kids and found that there was no spread, there was no influenza in the older individuals because you would
in the youngsters.
Right, stop them in the youngsters first. So my marker for influenza being a problem every year is when the Catholic elementary schools start closing because of illness. That's a marker for, hey, they've got a lot of influenza.
And it's likely to spread to the adults.
Right, exactly.
Interesting. So now there are antiviral medications if someone does get the flu, and there's also been some talk about using that instead of the flu to decrease the chance of getting the flu.
There are two classes of antivirals that are effective against influenza. And we would use them to prevent influenza and outbreaks in institutions like nursing homes, or say in hospitals, but more often than nursing homes. And we're going to be using more of it this year because some nursing homes just don't have access to the influenza vaccine.
So when we see a case of the flu, we're going to give everyone who lives in that general area, generally on the same wing or floor, the antiviral drug.
Exactly. So the game plan is going to be to have enough supply of these agents available to deal with this issue. The problem is the side effect profile of these drugs can be significant in the elderly. So we have to be a little bit careful in dosing and so forth.
And what kind of side effects would
that
be?
Well, the drugs with the major side effects in the elderly are amantadine and rimantadine. These are drugs that are very effective against one type of influenza, influenza A. The side effects we're dealing with are such things as falling, changes in mental status and that sort of thing, which are can be significant in the elderly, especially in the nursing home population. So if you reduce the dose, you can avoid most of these complications.
Okay, let's get into the other types of vaccinations quickly. The Pneumovax, there's also talk about recommending a tetanus booster or a DTP, pertussis immunization. What can you tell us about those?
Well, the pneumonia vaccine, or Pneumovax, is for all the groups that we talked about in terms of the influenza vaccine, the same recommendations are made for the pneumonia vaccine in an attempt to reduce the occurrence of pneumonia in the elderly. Now, the elderly have a double whammy, if you will. The highest incidence of pneumonia is in the elderly, and the highest mortality rates related to pneumonia are in the elderly. So the goal is to...
So you definitely want to prevent it in that age group.
The problem that we run into is that the pneumonia vaccine is not as effective in the elderly as it is in younger age groups, again, because of the lesser immune response that occurs in the elderly, unfortunately. And there's active research now ongoing to try to find a better vaccine for the prevention of pneumonia.
Now, some people have heard that they just need to get the pneumonia vaccine once in a lifetime. Is that true?
Well, again, that's the party line from the experts. Or if you look at the information that's published on this, for instance, if you get vaccinated at age 80 for the first time, the likelihood that you're going to still have immunity at age 85 is probably less than 25% of the time. So, at least in the nursing home setting, my recommendation has been that every 5 years you should receive the vaccine again. That's my bias, and it's not written anywhere, but that's my reading of the literature on that. Right now, if you receive the vaccine and you're relatively healthy before age 65, the recommendation is that once you reach age 65, you get vaccinated one more time. That's the present recommendation. But I think we're dealing with a lot of older individuals now, especially in the nursing home setting, 80s, 90s, and I will recommend vaccinating them every 5 years. Whether that helps or not, we don't know.
Oh, in the community, too. The average age of the patients I saw this past Friday was probably 85 to 90, and as high as 95, 96. Let's hear from the other patients that I talked to. It'll be track 7, 8, and 9. We'll play them all together and then talk about them, and then we'll wrap up the show.
I'm trying to think of all the different parts of my body where I might have had an infection, and probably a urinary would be the worst.
Okay.
And how old are
you when you had it?
Probably in my 40s.
40s? Nothing as you've gotten older?
No.
Nothing for the last 50 years?
No, I don't take any medication. I don't know. I've had colds. Is that an infection?
Yeah.
Well, okay. I had a cold a couple weeks ago.
Okay. And how do you deal with that?
I took a couple of aspirin the first day, and then I just let it run its course, ended with a cough, and that kind of went away, but it lasted maybe a couple of weeks. No antibiotics. I didn't see anybody.
So your immune system is still working strong?
Seems to be.
At how many years of age?
96.
An infection in my leg near the ankle that was very dry skin, so I scratched it, and evidently bacteria entered that open scratch, and the infection has been bothering me for 5 months so far. Hopefully we're on the right track.
And how did you get it?
I don't know. I was fixing soup one night on a Friday, and I got the chills and went to bed. I felt terrible for all week. I see it was something. I can't. But my grandson found it, and he's a college kid, and he found it on the internet or something before the doctors knew what the hell it was.
What was the worst infection you've ever had in your life?
I've been fortunate in having very few infections. One I remember when I was in nursing, I had a boil, which was really very bad, and they had to lance it and all this kind of stuff.
Did you need antibiotics as well?
We didn't have antibiotics at that time.
not even mercury?
Okay, well, we heard from more of my patients, and a bunch of issues came up. One person, 96 years old, rode through her cold and got better on its own. Someone who had a boil and was lanced, and that got better before the antibiotic era. And we had another patient who got information about his problem by having his grandson go on the internet. So let's talk about when you can let an infection ride out, when it's important to seek an antibiotic or when you shouldn't seek an antibiotic, and what resources are out there for people to find out more about infections they might have.
Well, the lady describing her viral infection is interesting, because we've all had that experience where it sort of drags on for 2 or 3 weeks. Certainly I have. And after it drags on for about 2 weeks and you're coughing and so forth, the common thing is, well, I'm going to go see my doctor to get an antibiotic. And it's really not necessary. These are viral infections, and when viruses attack the respiratory tree, they damage this hair-like cells and so on and so forth that we talked about earlier, and you get cough from that. The damage to those cells leads to cough. It sounds lousy. It tends to be a situation where you're coughing a lot, but you don't feel that bad. And that's almost always a viral process. It doesn't require antibiotic therapy. And she's a perfect example of that. You get better eventually, 10 times out of 10. And it's a nice demonstration of that. The lady with the boil is also interesting, because most of the time these localized abscesses in the skin, all they need to be done is drained. And they will get better in somebody with a relatively normal immune system.
I remember a dermatology professor stating a Latin phrase which basically meant, where there's pus, you get rid of it, and that's how you deal with things like boils.
Well, we just had a lady I saw in the hospital with a very large abscess on her bottom side, and it was nicely lanced open and drained very effectively, and we didn't put her on any antibiotics, and she got better, and off she went. So that's... And physicians tend to treat these things with antibiotics, and very often not necessary. The drainage is the key factor with these abscesses.
Well, what would you say to docs that have a patient come in and almost expect an antibiotic when they get a viral illness?
This is a major problem, and there's been a major effort on the part of CDC and third party payers and so forth to a blitz, if you will, and to attempt to educate people about the fact that most of these are viral infections and antibiotics are not indicated. And the driving force of that is the issue of resistance. That's a major problem for us, both in the community setting and the hospital. I think these kinds of education efforts are very important to educate the public that, these are mostly viral. There's no treatment for it except symptomatic, as the lady in the interview nicely demonstrated. Took some Tylenol, took some aspirin, and I just worked my way through it. So I think it's an educational process. It can be difficult at times with an individual person, because they say, well, I've got sinusitis, or I've got this, I've got that. I think it takes time to deal with that properly.
Well, I know when I am confronted with that kind of situation, I increase the monitoring. I ask my patient to call me back if they're not better in a few days, and to call me back as soon as they feel worse.
Well, that's a very good point. And I think part of the educational process that these various organizations are putting forth is just that you continue to monitor, make sure you're improving. If not, revisit the physician, contact the physician again. And that should be part of the routine approach. Yeah, I agree.
Now, what about resources that are out there for people to learn more about infections?
Yeah, I think the best resource, one of the best resources for the public is the CDC website, which has many, many different topics discussed on their website that in plain language. And that's cdc.gov, G-O-V. And the New York State Department of Health, their website also has a lot of useful information. The County Health Department website also has a lot of useful information about vaccines and a lot of these various infections that we've talked about.
And the CDC stands for the Centers for Disease Control.
Right.
It's a governmental agency, and you hear a lot of them in the news, especially now with the flu vaccine problem. Certainly AIDS has been a big issue over the years. And I believe also the National Institutes of Health has a section on infectious disease.
Yes, they do.
That might also be a resource for people.
There's another one, National Foundation of Infectious Disease, which is another organization that has information.
Any final thoughts or advice to people out there about infections?
Infections are inevitable in all of us. What's interesting is you've given some examples of people in their 80s and 90s who've never had infection, and they're a success story for all intents and purposes. There are people, that's why they're 80 or 90 years old. They have been able to
survive.
Avoid their survivors, if you will, for whatever reason, genetics, good luck, and so forth. I think the key things in basic infection prevention for an individual comes back to the issue of hand washing that we mentioned previously. That will really reduce your risk of infection. You know, we're constantly touching all sorts of things in our daily lives that hundreds of other people have touched, and we will pick up viruses primarily on our hands and then transmit them to the respiratory tract or wherever. So hand washing is actually very important. During influenza season, with coughing, sneezing, and so forth, we shouldn't be covering our mouth with our hand, because all we're doing is contaminating our hand, and that'll start contaminating, you know, various other objects in the environment. So use a tissue if you can, if it's available.
Sneeze to the side, not in the direction of someone.
Sneeze into your arm or something like that, something that won't contaminate your hands.
Well, thanks so much for being here today. Very interesting, very helpful to everyone out there. It's always a refresher for me as well. Thanks also to Art Neville for singing Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie Woogie Flu. Next Monday, I will be here to take your calls, and we'll be talking about living options for seniors. My guest will be Mr. Robert Meese, President and CEO of Beechwood Continuing Care, which includes the Beechwood Residence and Nursing Home, Bloker Homes, and Asbury Point, and Mr. Mike Maloney, Executive Director of the Greenfields Senior Living Facilities in the Niagara Lutheran Health System. And thank you to Jimmy for reading Expectations at the beginning of the show. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. I'll see you next week.